Welcome everybody to our, I think, second cold day up here at Chikoji. It's been so hot and warm up here that this coolness, we didn't even bother starting the fire because we wanted to feel it today, and I think everybody got plenty cold. And it was nice to share the 80 minutes of breathing together and the silence to figure out why we're here, what we're doing, what this is. So today, I'm going to talk a little bit about some aspects out of the Diamond Sutra, where we talk about the self, where the self, our self, our being, our life, and our soul. The Atma is the self. The Sattva is a being. The Jiva is the life. And our soul is called in Sanskrit Pudgala. And I think as we live, we have a chance to investigate fully our life, our being, our self, what it is, our self, the ego, our habits, our tendencies, this being, we're human, terrestrial. We amble along. We have a throbbing heart. We inhale and we expire. Our being, the sattva, this life, our commitments, our accomplishments, our failings, our shortcomings, disappointments, our goals, and then our soul, which, where does it come from? Where does it go? But I wonder if our soul embodies our core directive. Where we each have a core directive in our life. For me, it's been to serve in all the different areas where I function. For others, it may be to teach, to facilitate, to accompany, to mother, to father, to accumulate. I think there are those that their core directive is to accumulate. Some, it's great wealth. But to investigate thoroughly and relentlessly and honestly and meet ourselves takes not only what Karen talked about a few weeks ago, fearlessness, but also patience and kindness for ourselves. So we can choose to investigate our life, our Atma, the Sattva, the Jiva, the Pudgala. We can choose to meet this, to face this body, this life, and feel it, really feel it, using our instruments, our skandhas, our senses, our sense organs, and to fully witness and be fully open and awake. And one of the nice things about Zazen, the Soto Zen practice of meditation, is there are so many different kinds of meditation and contemplation that are all useful and valid. But the Zazen, Shikantaza, is of just sitting. We meet ourselves with our breath, with each breath. And that allows us to focus our attention on something quite fundamental. And the cool thing about it being so fundamental is that our breath, when we experience it, we don't make distinctions about it. We can notice that we're breathing fast or we're out of air, but generally when we breathe, it's one of the fundamental experiences we have, that is that we can catch a glimpse of no distinction. And so to be able to focus our attention on our breath, we can't really control our senses. You know, we can try and stave off hunger. We can satisfy our different urges or needs. But basically, the thing we have in most control, most of our control, is our focus. And so we can focus on our breath, we can focus on our life or what's before us, and then when we get crazy, we can come back to something quite simple and focus on our breath or how our body feels, where it feels, how our skeleton feels. And by just being able to direct our focus to that specifically, we have some control in what we focus on. And for people in pain, I don't feel much pain in my life, but from what I know from people who do, that being able to focus on things is what their salvation is. So as we sit here, we're part of, there's some dispute, there are 8 or 9 planets in our solar system. It used to be 9, but maybe it's only 8 now. But we have millions of other bodies that are part of our solar system. So we sit here with all of that rotating around our sun, and our solar system rotating around the Milky Way galaxy, and last night was spectacular, bright starlight. You could see the Milky Way straight up, which means if the Milky Way's, the arms of the Milky Way is like this at that point, of course, then it's going to rotate. But at that point, we're either going that way or we're going that way. And I'm not sure which way we're going, but we're going pretty fast. We're going about 200 miles a second. And that's kind of hard to conceive of. I guess like from here to, where?
Chico.
In a second. Like how can we get there how can this mass move that fast? I mean, and the Earth is kind of big, and the sun is pretty big, and all this mass is moving pretty fast, so there's all this momentum. There's this huge momentum that we're part of in this universe. And then we get really annoyed with little things like the guy in front of us when we're driving down the road. And sometimes we're driving down the road, especially 280, one of the most beautiful freeways in the world. People come to visit California, traffic engineers from around the world, and I think 280 is one of them they show off. But there have been times where driving down the freeway, 80 miles an hour. It's like they're 12, 15 cars that are all going 80. We're all going 80 miles an hour, and just feels like there's this huge harmony. And then somebody thinks, I could get some advantage. And so they pull on ahead of somebody, and somebody else starts looking over to the side, and their foot goes off the gas. And so suddenly this harmony becomes disharmony, or a different kind of harmony as we float along. And none of us are really thinking about our momentum as we're driving down that freeway, unless some obstruction comes and we got to put on the brakes, and then suddenly it's like, wow, we got to stop. So there's this natural momentum we have in our day. Down the highway, walking down the sidewalk, things that we move and meet, obstructions that we hit when we're walking, feel quite uncomfortable, especially as we get older, it hurts. And so we have this momentum. And I look at our life as having momentum too. I guess that's our karma, has momentum. And you know, we get to go all these great places, including here to Jokoji. You know, about 40, 50, 60 years ago, there was an equipment operator that was driving a dozer and carved the road that made it possible for us to get down here. But still, when you pull off the highway, you see the new Jokoji sign, and you pull off and you start going down that road. It's like a bumpy, bumpy road, and you finally get down here to the bottom and you say, I made it. Well, you didn't make it. The dozer operator made it. Thank you, Romney. Anyway, but when we arrive here, did we really make it here anyway? Where are we? So, when we look at our lives and we've accomplished something that we've set out to do, and we say, I did it. Really, we had a lot of help. We had a lot of help from this material world to pull together those components, all the people that had prepared all those other elements that we were able to craft and make into what we finally manifest. So in the Diamond Sutra, on chapter 3, the Buddha says to Sabuddhi, and Sabuddhi is one of the Shravakas, and Buddha says to him, those who would now set out on the bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. How many beings there are in whatever realms of being may exist, whether born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception or no perception, and whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in this realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Sabuddhi, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. Who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul. So when we create a perception, right now I'm thinking that this turns on the notion of creating a perception. When we create a perception, we witness what we watch. I was, one of my jobs recently was, I worked on a tunnel. I was a tunnel inspector, and my mantra was, I witness, I watch, that's my job. I witness, I watch, that's my job. I witness, I watch, that's my job. So I just thought that actually that's pretty much what we do. You know, we witness and watch in our day. And some of us get paid as inspectors and others of us don't. But we all do that. But a question I want to ask is, how far along in the process of our consciousness is creating a perception? And to use an example of hearing a loud sound, you know, we're startled. That's not a perception. We're startled. And then it dawns on us what it is. We listen and calibrate what it was that we, where are we, what is it? Is it safe? And then in just milliseconds, you know, we're thinking, the thought process evolves. There's the combining of our sense organs. It's sifting through, we're sifting through the data, we're reassembling it, we're summarizing it, and we say, oh, okay. And then that perception kind of terminates. We bow out of that perception and move on to what's next. And often it's just the thought trains that we are often or most often encumbered with. And so really most of our day is we're spent thinking about things. So as far as my question is, a bodhisattva who creates the perception is already making an assessment, is discerning the elements, is attempting to understand, and then one, I think repulsion is not, I'm not sure if repulsion is a perception, it may be more of a reaction, but often when, for example, there's an awful smell, we are repulsed. And so is that perception, that repulsion to, again, there's a whole thread of assessing what is this, and then it go, then finally it's like, ooh, I got to get out of here, or ooh, that's really awful. And so So a repulsion is actually a derivative of a perception. It's a subsequent of a perception. But when we're watching our breath, the in and out of our breath, and we can feel the air coming in and the air exiting, we can also just stop once the air has left our body for a few seconds and experience our life in that moment. And when we focus like that, our thoughts are not engaged. We're present. And so maybe the flavor of a perception is actually a derivative of the experience. In calculus, there are derivatives where you start with one element and then you relate it to time, to space, and it has another aspect to it. For example, you have speed down the highway, but if you gas it up or put on the brakes, you're accelerating or decelerating, and that change in speed is a derivative. So when a perception, so maybe the flavor of a perception is a judgment of a perception is a derivative of a perception. And so the so creating a perception may also be a derivative of the full experience of just being immersed in this. Darlene Cohen, one thing she said was, we should remember when we make distinctions that we are free to not make them as well. And that's most useful, because that when we know we don't need to make distinctions, or we can make distinctions, we cannot make distinctions, we can control our focus. Now, when we're when we have a chance to experience an epiphany, an epiphany is a dynamic state of mental clarity and penetration of absolute and relative and absolute. And I wonder if an epiphany is like Sambhogaya. There we have Dharmakaya, the absolute, the essence of the universe. We have Sambhogakaya, which is the combining of the absolute and the relative. And then we have the Nirmanakaya, which is life and death, our suffering. And I just wonder if an epiphany, because I think everybody here has epiphanies, and sometimes we have them quite frequently, and other times it's been dry for many weeks. But I see epiphanies as small, they're small illuminations, they're small enlightenments. And my background is also in geology, where, you know, we look at the processes of the earth and the planets and the back in the early 1800s, there was a lot of question about how this place was made. And of course, there were a lot of people who studied the earth and the terrain who believed that God made it in 7 days, and that these massive formations like we see in Utah of massive sandstone formations were caused by the flood, the big flood. And then there were some other geologists that came along and they said, well, actually, the processes that we see today are the processes that have always taken place. And in a way, that idea, it reminds me in the Heart Sutra of the dharmas do not increase nor decrease. They are not tainted or pure. And so what we see is how it's been, how it is, how it will be. And so when we hear about enlightenment, it seems like something pretty spectacular. And what I wanted to suggest is that perhaps when we have epiphanies, that actually we're experiencing awakening. And it's a dynamic process. It happens, and then we're off our epiphany. We get something from it. We might remember it. We might write it down. It opens us up to our world and to perceive again and again. And so to foster our, cultivate our life in a way so that we can have more epiphanies might help us back to the Big Bang, the big kahunga of enlightenment, you know, with all these little parts. And as in geology, the little elements of seeing the water flow and carrying sediment down the stream is part of the processes that exist. We get to witness it and taste it, and it is all present already, and we don't have to go anywhere to find it. And we each get to do that. We don't need to be in somebody else's body to do it. We don't need to have what somebody else has to have it. We each get to, wherever we happen to be, we can experience the extraordinary ordinariness of this. So I was thinking about what I do in a day, and I wrote down here, I'll go through it rather quickly, what I do in a day. I sleep, eat, drink, walk, ride, walk, sit, talk, read, sit, talk, read, walk, look, talk, and talk, walk, talk, look, walk, sit, write, read, write, read, write, sign off, walk, ride, and home. Finally, I'm home, and I wash my hands and read into the evening, and I get paid to do that. And that's, I didn't move much dirt, I didn't move much rock, I didn't move much of anything, except feel pretty important from time to time, or oops, I made a mistake. So I wanted to ask the idea of creating a perception. If any of you have any thoughts on that or anything else that you might want to bring up. Judy?
Well, I think I'm asking, really, did I hear you correctly? I think you were either reading or referring to the Diamond Sutra, and there was a passage in which it said that a bodhisattva does not form an impression, or does not form a perception.
Create a perception?
Yeah, create a perception. And can you, because I don't understand that, could you elaborate on that?
Of creating a perception.
Well, why? What's the relationship with that? With the bodhisattva, the absence of creating a perception. Is this an essential part of being a bodhisattva? Is that what it says?
It says you are not a bodhisattva if you create a perception of a self, a being, a life, or a soul.
And that perception is, of course, of yourself, your inner perception. It's not someone else's perception of you that is being referred to. It's your own perception of yourself. You don't perceive yourself as a being, or a life, or a soul.
But how can we not? So on the other hand, you know, we examine our life, we examine our physical well-being, we examine our what we have to do in a day, we perceive our life, we perceive our well-being, but maybe in that moment we're not with the big picture of a bodhisattva. But on the other hand, maybe it takes fully examining all of that, like for a lot, to actually at some point be able to drop it all. And just then you see this, just this. But then we go back and we examine again and again. So does that make us not a bodhisattva? Maybe it makes us a being at that time.
Well, if you think of it as kind of a verb, you know, being, I mean, the bodhisattva is an act rather than a being, something like that, right? I'll go with that.
Okay. Michael?
I was thinking about the Buddhist statement. It was made early on in his teaching career when he said that what he had to teach was against the current of what we might call the normative current of being, that what he had to present, and he was initially reluctant to share it because of that, his experience. Like our normative current is to make a self, and you can see the logic of it if we, in scientific terms, that we have to make a separate self to, it's part of our survival package, you know, to isolate a separate self and make it protected or make it survive. This is almost this against the current practice of Buddhism of the Bodhisattva in the Diamond Sutras. Actually, in a certain sense, we're going against our evolutionary history of making an isolated self. We're actually kind of cutting through that, making another kind of evolution or another cut through that and to not, you know, to actually exist without selfing, without being, without that activity. Very interesting that that's stated so emphatically in the Dhamma Sutra.
Mm-hmm. Kendra?
You mentioned what Darlene Cohen has said about how every time we make a perception that we have also, that we need to realize we also have a choice not to make a perception. And
or so distinction.
Distinction. Mm-hmm. Is it close?
Sure.
This feeling of shimmering back and forth from the self-based culture and civilization and necessity you mentioned, Michael, and this other way. We're just shimmering back and forth. We never completely enter the bodhisattva realm. As Judy said, it's more of a verb. But at least it's there for us to see as often as we can shimmer into that realm.
It seems like the notion of self that you were talking about, Michael, too, was, you know, when we need to protect ourselves or create the self, it's basically a fear-based, protective-based aspect of our life that starts cutting off the links to the surrounding area. And so maybe with a more fearless, open, trusting, kind, generous, sense of being, we're not creating a perception. We're welcoming all of it. And I think to use the verb bodhisattva-ing, when you're a mother and you're walking with one of your kids who's starting, a toddler who's starting to run, and they start to fall, and you reach down immediately and catch them before they fall, or they do fall and they cry and you immediately pick them up, that there is no thought in that. There, you are taking care of all of it. And so I wonder about this creating a perception. Is it a derivative of just an open, welcoming consciousness? Is that a one step deviation away from full on experience, open experience? Todd?
I have to say, it seems to be your mind is trying to define, making a perception of a perception by putting a label. Does that then clear you of not no longer making a perception, a word?
Yeah. I think the word of, you know, the self, creating a perception of a self, whether it's a self or a good self or a bad good other or a bad other, once those words crop in, then the distinctions begin. And we need them. But we can also perhaps not use them from time to time. Yes?
Again, though, the strength I see of sitting still, really still, is it dissipates that need. I don't need a label. It is, you know. Sitting here with everyone at the wall, this opportunity, or however you define it, this is what is confronted in some ways, is the lack of need of that label. And it reminds me of a child again. My newborn daughter comes out and she holds that finger really tight. A need, instinct for structure or security or fear.
From the beginning.
From the beginning. And much like what Michael said, it seems from time immemorial, this is where we are anyway, but having to practice cutting through that, I guess.
Had a number of reactions, but been thinking of self or self-creation or self-generation as we go along. I think of that in terms of ego primarily, and that it's a misunderstanding from a misunderstanding. Somehow, words are not necessarily part of that, as in the beginning there were words, or in the beginning was the word. Somehow, words are fundamentally outside the universe. But we and science are inside the universe. So somehow we have to use our science as well as our Buddhism to arrive at, you know, to get closer, I think. And some of the things that we're saying are sort of in conflict with one or the other. So I worry about that a little bit.
What's in conflict?
100 million kalpas is beyond the age of the universe. And therefore, it's beyond time, space, and everything, I admit.
And yet a rock about this size has 100 million kalpas of... Now, kalpa is a time element, but it has a certain number of seconds in it. And 100,000 million kalpas has a certain number of seconds, which might be older than our universe, and yet the number of atoms in that, in a rock this size.
It could be on the order of 10 to the 23rd or something like that.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's still just a number.
It's just a number. It's inconceivable. Yeah.
So, there's a fundamental distinction of what our lives are and what life is in general. And I get that a little bit confused with nirvana and thinking of everything's in this big ocean. But life, according to science, is sort of the reproducing. It starts with a reproducing cell, so it's not going back to the inanimate stuff.
Isn't there something about reaction to stimulus too, as a definition of life?
I didn't hear that.
So reaction, that the definition of life includes the reaction to stimulus.
Yes.
No.
From Science 101.
That's one of the five characteristics of life.
Anyway, I may be off on 100 sign tracks.
So, you know, when you have a rock, which this is right now, its current surface is what it is now, but recently it had a thinner, thicker elements to it, which...
But they all were born less than 15 billion years ago. The whole thing, as far as we know scientifically, is limited to that scope.
Okay.
But that rock is really evolved because it's recording your voices.
It's very evolved, and it's reacting. So is there life in this rock?
No, it's purely inanimate in that thing. Except that it contains the word in some sense. Like, that's a bit confusing because that's beyond the universe.
Todd?
Kendra.
Or Kendra?
The 100,000 million kulpas of time. Pretty long time. I wonder whether when that was written, whether they had a word for infinity. And the context is that something is rarely met with, even in, let's substitute in the infinite set of moments that have ever happened. And it makes sense if you say it is rarely met with, and you could just leave off the rest of it. It's not, as far as I understand, it's saying a certain thing happened 100,000 million years ago or a kulpas ago. It just says this thing is rarely met with, even in the infinity of all time.
Talk to Michael.
And yet we meet it moment by moment.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's unavoidable.
John?
Well, I think this question would be directed to Cliff. So what is zero? Is it the infinite, or is it nothing?
It's a number.
What does it represent?
Nothing. 1 minus 1, 10 minus 10.
But it's not the infinite.
Only if you divide it into something.
Only if you cut infinity in half, Greg.
Or you say it just.
I know, these guys are all crazy, frankly.
Yes.
Do all perceptions create division and.
What do you think?
Yes.
So creating a perception creates a division.
Yeah, because if you have a perception perceived according to what else, whether it comes from the left place.
Mm-hmm.
And does it create separation at that point?
So that's what's happening, is creating a perception creates a division.
Yeah, and creates separation.
And separation. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's about perceptions at all. It's about creating entities. So you're supposed not to create something that doesn't exist, like that it's Doug here sitting opposite to me. Of course, I have a perception, but it makes a difference if I make a something out of it.
A person.
For example, a person, a soul, a life. So I think having perceptions is not the problem. The problem is to refrain from making some kind of entity, lasting entity out of it. So that could be the task of a bodhisattva to let it be, to just stop that or diminish it or try to do less of that, as I understand. So if you start to trick around with this perception thing, you it's a problem, you know? then you would have to decide what is a perception, what is not a perception. Does every perception lead to an entity or not? It's very tricky. Difficult to say.
So start with not creating a perception of something.
No, perceptions just are. Don't you think so?
So it isn't to not create a perception, but it's not to create a perception of something, of a self, of a being, of a life,
so
of a soul.
So if you find yourself thinking, well, I'm talking now to Doug, then maybe if you try to say, well, maybe I should not insist that this is Doug. So we automatically do something like this, maybe, or we have learned to do something like this. I'm talking to you. I'm very inclined to think I'm talking with Doug. So if I could stop this or let that be, that would be good. I think that's the point of this. I cannot stop seeing something or whatever. Shall I be blind?
I don't think that's what it's saying.
It doesn't say that I should be blind.
I was doing a specific kind of geotechnical construction work for a while, and then I stopped doing it, and I went off to be a house dad and take care of kids in San Francisco that were musicians. And it was like several months since I had kind of stopped doing that and went on to do something completely different. Completely different. There were all sorts of things that I had experienced in that thorough immersion as a geotechnical contractor that was rich. But now I found myself walking down this 20th Street and between Pacheco and down to Moraga, and it just felt like I had no knowledge. I had no basket of knowledge anymore. I didn't have this bag of Doug the contractor, geotechnical contractor, with me anymore. It was just gone. And then somebody asked me a particular question about something, and suddenly all that knowledge just was right back. And so I just...
Was that refreshing to be without it?
Yes.
It was good.
And it was amazing to have it all available still.
Yeah.
So it's...
We're very fast that way. Somehow. We can recreate a self thing. Actually, when we wake up every morning, we do that. Doesn't it seem that way?
Mm-hmm.
We put together, in a second or so, we put together, boom, a self, and then we take this body out of bed, make a cup of coffee.
And now we can go and nourish it. One more question, Kendra?
I enjoyed the analogy with the first derivative, like acceleration, the speed over time and space. And that made me think of Dogen and different ways that there are of thinking about time. And so if we have several completely different ways to think about time, and of course different ways to think about space too, then if we're thinking of perceptions as something that's derivative, did I understand you right in the way you were using that word, perceptions, that if it's not completely attached to time and space, then that step of going into perception can be questioned as well?
Yeah.
That's a good thought. But I don't know how to answer that.
I'm sorry, it is a phrase that it was just a thought.